Sports journalism is often cheap, sensational, and obsequious. And I don't just mean mine. Since the time of the Roman gladiators in the first century BCE, which, of course, means before Carmen Electra, the Onion has stood apart in its coverage of sports, lampooning the overpraised, encouraging the underdog, and lowering cholesterol with diet and exercise. They have a new collection out, The Ecstasy of Defeat, sports reporting at its finest by the editors of The Onion. And we're joined by John Krusen, sports editor, and Seth Reese, who is head writer at The Onion. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
And we want to note this book is printed on 6 grams of soluble fiber, which is good for all of us, isn't it?
Nature's broom.
Let's get to some of the highlights in this collection. You broke the story a couple of years ago that Roger Clemens' family had offered him $10 million to stay home.
Well, it was a lucrative contract for him to stay home 3 years with his kids and wife, with an option for a fourth year to spend a little more time with cousins, relatives, and just, I guess, being a normal father.
Rather than taking more steroids and playing into his 50s or 60s.
Exactly. Right. It was a good deal for him, even though it was from a small market family where he'd get less exposure than from, say, a team.
Ultimately, he did turn down the opportunity to be a good father and husband.
Now, what the story The Onion broke, which I found just fascinating, what happens to great race cars like the Chevy Impala that was driven by Jimmy Johnson?
His number 48?
Yeah, when they just get to the end of the line.
That particular one was put out to stud. And, you know, it has 4,800 acres of tarmac in North Carolina to just roam around on. And then they expose it to other race cars and, let nature take its course.
National Hockey League might get more exposure if the NBA doesn't play this year. How is the NHL preparing for the upcoming season?
Well, what they do, Scott, is they take all the water they can and they freeze it and they perfectly carve it into the shape of ice hockey rinks, load them into trucks, and then drive them to all the hockey arenas. Sometimes you don't quite know if you can get all the ice through the front door. They have to chop up the ice when they get to the arena into little cubes to get it through the door and then onto the facade.
Sports is really in the details, in every little detail. I mean, just pick up Sports Illustrated and you can see that. They cover stuff that's unbelievably painstaking that you would never think you'd want to read about.
Oh, gin rummy tournaments, right? That sort of thing.
See? You wouldn't think you'd want to read about that.
But you do.
The Pittsburgh Steelers, right? One of the great initial franchises of the National Football League.
Right.
And for years, they had a nickname, the Steel Curtain Defense.
Brutal defense.
I mean, look, that's not the Pittsburgh we know today, is it?
You know, if you're going up and down the Allegheny River, you don't see the steel mills, you don't see the steam coming out anymore. It's more technology firms.
Medical billing.
I mean, they're at the forefront of the healthcare industry, so the Steelers' defense had to rename their defense the mid-level white-collar curtain to more accurately reflect contemporary Pittsburgh.
They wanted to just call it the medical billing curtain because that's guaranteed to freeze your blood. But, as menacing as that was, they had to include the whole city of Pittsburgh. That's the great thing about that community.
And it is still on the table to change the name of the team entirely. Some of the names, the Pittsburgh Biomedical Technicians and the Pittsburgh 8th Most Fortune 500 Company Corporate Headquarters Hosters.
Wow. There's always something else you can learn.
We're a treasure trove of information at The Onion. We're just bringing it out.
We're the back of life's baseball card.
We want to raise this matter carefully on, but after all, weekend family drive time show.
Right.
But I think sports fans all over the world really were just astonished when golf's greatest player, Tiger Woods, had a car crash a couple years ago, then marital discord. And sports fans kept asking, when will this most dominant scorer of all time return to championship play?
He didn't want to speak to any other publication.
He did, yeah, and we broke that story, and we do understand it's a family show. Mm-hmm. He was really great. I mean, he's great at it. One of the best in the world. And to see him get back out there is great. It was great to see.
I, of course, don't really follow golf, so I didn't actually watch, but I did read the recaps, and his numbers just were he hadn't lost a stroke.
I mean, listen to this quote from a fan here. "I'm so glad Tiger is coming back," said 27-year-old Florida resident and cocktail waitress Brandy Hughes. He's the best. Exactly.
It means a lot to fans, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
That Tiger's back in the hunt. Finally, I think an article only The Onion could do What can you tell us about the only soccer fan in the United States?
He's insufferable.
Brad Janovich is his name. Yeah. And it's a weird thing about
this is the guy I must get emails from all the time telling me we're not paying enough attention.
He seems to, yeah, Brad seems to want us to really love soccer. And when we don't, he gets all shirty about it. Oh, when the World Cup rolls around, it's hard to be around Brad.
Yeah, I mean, he puts up these weird flags and weird, like, sweater blanket-type things.
Is that a scarf he's got?
Some sort of scarf.
I thought it was a Doctor Who thing, and as far as I'm concerned, it may as well be.
I know this is a bit of editorializing, and that's not good in our field, but I think Brad's the worst.
Brad is terrible.
Yeah.
He's a bad person.
Yeah, the worst is kind of a qualitative judgment, but I think just saying terrible.
Well, I think as long as Brad is that bad, though, there's not going to be a second soccer fan in the United States, you know, at least in our lifetimes.
Gentlemen, thank you both very much for this collection and the really the very fierce and principled coverage of sports that the Onion provides to all of us who love the game, whatever it is.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, sir.
And all of your courage. Wait, who said that? Courage. John Crewson, who's sports editor of The Onion, and Seth Rees, head writer of The Onion. Their new book, out October 11th, but no need to rush. There'll be plenty of copies. Onion Sports, The Ecstasy of Defeat. Oh, with a foreword, by the way, by Anabolic Steroids.
So a few minutes ago, you heard me freaking out at the haunted house. And, okay, it was pretty funny. But here's something else for you. That's the scene from Alien, where the baby alien bursts out of someone's chest. Now that is true horror. Alien is one of a bunch of classic horror movies featured in a new book called Shock Value: How a Few Eccentric Outsiders Gave Us Nightmares, Conquered Hollywood, and Invented Modern Horror. Jason Zinnemann is the author, and he's at our New York bureau. Welcome, Jason.
Great to be here.
So, Jason, your book's about the invention of modern horror. And, you know, I assume that all this stuff goes back to, you know, Boris Karloff and Nosferatu and all those classic monster films. But that's not really what you're talking about here, is it?
No, and just to some extent, I mean, you could say modern horror started with Universal Classics or even before that, as you say, with Nosferatu. I do think there is this significant turning point starting in 1968. The movies I look at are from that period to the end of the 70s. And the reason for it is I think that the horror genre today, which is bigger than it's ever been, many, many, many of the tropes and motifs from the horror genre today come from this period. And I think it was a huge transition from the kind of old horror, Karloff and Vincent Price and a lot of these old monster movies, to the kind of new brand of scares that you saw with The Rosemary's Baby and Alien and Halloween.
So I think we know what a classic horror film, you know, pre-1970s look like. Usually there was a monster, maybe a classic Dracula or Frankenstein. There was clearly a force of evil, and then there was a force of good, and the force of evil would attack the force of good, and in the end, good would win, and in between, people maybe got scared a little bit with like, oh, I want to suck your blood kind of thing. So what are the qualities of modern horror? What did we start to see in the late 1960s, in the 1970s that changed all that?
Well, I think a couple of things. One thing that you're putting your finger on is it became much more morally ambiguous. There was much more of a sense of confusion and disorientation. There were many more unhappy endings. It also, starting in the late 60s, partially influenced by documentary and cinema verite, it became much more realistic. Horror moved from being something very remote about a spooky house in Transylvania to about the prom queen at your local high school, or about going to the beach with your family.
You talk in your book quite a bit about Rosemary's Baby.
What have you done to it? What have you done to its eyes?
He has his father's eyes.
In what ways was this really sort of this icon of this new kind of horror?
Well, first of all, just the fact that a major studio was producing this potboiler about the devil, directed by, you know, this art house filmmaker from Europe. You know, one of the real defining characteristics of horror before this period is just how disreputable it was. The other thing that I think Polanski introduced in it is this element of realism. You know, he took the supernatural story and he shot it on location in New York. He made it about things that people could relate to, the horrors of New York real estate.
Did she die in the apartment? Not that it makes
any difference. No. In a hospital.
And notably about Rosemary's Baby, unlike perhaps every other monster film before that, you didn't get to see the monster, just a tiny little bit of the baby. That was supposed to be the big scare, and yet he held back for the first time.
You know, one of the interesting things about this period, I read about this in the book, I call it the monster problem, which is every horror audience wants the same thing, which is to see the monster, loosely defined. And inevitably, when you see the monster, it's kind of an anticlimax. It's never as terrifying as what you could imagine. And, you know, one way to solve this problem is to keep the monster off screen for the most part.
You know, we're talking about these sort of psychological thriller, scary horror films. But at the same time, you said another revolutionary film was Night of the Living Dead. This is clearly one where the monster gets shown. In fact, many hundreds of the monsters get shown. What was Night of the Living Dead contributing to the horror genre of the time?
One element was the gore. You know, to see a little girl eat her father on screen in all its mess and blood. Back then, that was something relatively new. This kind of zombie, this flesh-eating zombie, was also something new. And, you know, the fact that it had this African-American protagonist who was a hero made the movie be seen by many critics and audiences as a kind of political statement. People started to see this and say, wait a second, a horror movie doesn't just have to be cheap fun. It can also make a serious point.
So after watching all these horror films and detailing the whole history of the genre, do you have a better idea of why people like this stuff?
I have many, many theories. I think there's a nostalgic pleasure being scared because some of our most potent scares are during childhood. And I think in a time when, you know, I'm often on my BlackBerry worried about three things that I have to do the next day and something I said the day before, I never feel more in the present than I'm when I'm scared at a horror film. And I think that is a very addictive feeling.
Well, those are all good brainy explanations, but maybe you're just a sicko.
Well, I would say that's also a big part of it.
That's Jason Zinnemann. His new book is Shock Value: How a Few Eccentric Outsiders Gave Us Nightmares, Conquered Hollywood, and Invented Modern Horror.
Thanks. Great to be here.
This is Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Smith, in today for Guy Raz. Up on Chandler Mountain in Alabama, it's harvest time. And every morning, Jamie Boatwright gets up early. By 6:30, he is out in the tomato fields, waiting.
Just seeing who all may show up to pick tomatoes that day.
It's not a bad time of year to work outside.
It's a beautiful sunny day.
Perfect temperature, 75 degrees.
Slight wind.
And Jamie Boatwright says the tomatoes are ready, a nice pink-orange glow. Big ones, the size of a softball.
Cherry tomatoes and also the Roma tomatoes.
But there is a problem.
We've got plenty of all of those different kinds of tomatoes and no pickers to pick them.
The fields here are quiet. Most of the Boatwright's usual workers have left Alabama, fled across the state line to Florida, too afraid to come out here and pick tomatoes. Late last week, a new immigration law went into effect in Alabama. The police can detain anyone they suspect of being an undocumented immigrant. Schools have to report the immigration status of their students. Life here on Chandler Mountain changed overnight.
Last week, we had 48 pickers at the beginning of the week. When the new law went into effect, we had eight.
Eight.
And it varies from day to day. Sometimes we have six, sometimes we have seven, sometimes eight. It just depends if, you know, their level of anxiety is towards being able to come to work that day.
Level of anxiety. That's the crazy thing. Jamie Boatwright says they actually got special work permits for their undocumented pickers. But that didn't matter. The men got scared. Why take a chance getting picked up by the police? There are fields in Florida with better work and fewer hassles. We called up Victor Spazzini in Birmingham. He's originally from Paraguay, and now he's an organizer with the Hispanic Interest Coalition of Alabama. He says he saw the flight for the border firsthand.
The mass exodus that began really all at one time was on September 28th, on that Wednesday. And that night, I had a family that's close to mine, and they left that same night at midnight with their children, and they gave their dogs away, and they were just weeping inconsolably as they drove away. They wanted to be out of the state before the sun rose, before the law was in effect.
We often speak about the immigration debate in terms of justice. Who has the right to be in this country? How far can you go to protect the borders? But there's an economic story here, too. Can businesses really function without undocumented workers? That's today's cover story. Whatever you think about the immigration policy in the United States, one thing is clear. There's the law, and then there's reality. Gordon Hansen studies the reality side of things at UC San Diego. He's an economist specializing in the impacts of immigration. Hansen says for decades there has been an unwritten social contract.
In which we said, we're not going to make it easy for you to get in. You're going to have to work hard because there are going to be some barriers at the border. It's going to cost you some money. It's going to cost you some time. It's going to cost you some personal risk. And what that did, in effect, was to select out people who weren't serious, to select out people who, for whom the opportunity of being in the United States didn't matter that much.
This was great for the workers who actually made it across the border because once they were here, they weren't hassled all that much. But it was also good for businesses, creating this ideal workforce.
What we got out of that previous policy was a population of undocumented workers who were very focused on working. They had higher employment rates than U.S. native-born workers.
Sure, there were flaws, but Hansen says that from a business point of view, at least it was stable, it was predictable. You could plan a business based on the reality of immigration enforcement. The new tougher laws in Alabama and Arizona change all that.
And what we're getting now in immigration is just chaos. Piecemeal reform undertaken at the state level with different states doing different things, making it harder for employers to hire illegal immigrants, with the federal government engaging in an additional set of tough enforcement actions both at the border and at the work site, creating a jumble. Employers just don't know what to think about what's going to come down the pike next.
That's the problem on Chandler Mountain. Jamie Boatwright doesn't know how many tomatoes to plant because now he has no idea if there's going to be anyone around to pick them. This is a perfect example of what Republicans are always talking about, regulatory uncertainty. Government, they say, should stop interfering in business, making life unpredictable for companies. And yet Republicans passed this new law in Alabama. Why upset the tomato cart? I talked to the sponsor of the bill, Alabama State Senator Scott Beeson, about why the status quo needed to change.
Let's take the construction industry, for example. Two people are competing with each other. Both of them may be framers. One of them, because we have low unemployment at that time, says, I'm going to hire some illegal workers. I don't care what the federal law is. I'm going to hire these folks. And because he can pay them a little bit less and he's able to get more jobs because he has this ever-increasing illegal workforce, he begins to grow. Well, his competitor down the street says, you know, I really don't want to hire any illegals. I know it's against the law, but if I'm going to survive, I need to go down that same route. Well, he begins to do that. And as they undercut the prices for their subcontractors, you begin to see people no longer in the drywall business, more difficult to be in the painting business, bricklaying, and that sort of thing. So over the years, you end up with a big problem growing where more and more people hire more and more illegals, which is a continued magnet to draw more people into the state. And we've gotten to that point, and now we have to try to fix that problem. And there's a little bit of jolt that happens when you stop the car and turn around and go the other way.
Now, while you were considering this law, you must have heard from businesses around the state. They're complaining now. I assume they were complaining then. What were they saying to you?
A number of these people are coming out and basically saying, you know, now we're in a tight because we can no longer hire people and continue to break what was a federal law. Now it's a state law. I understand there's going to be a readjustment time, but it's like any problem you got to fix. There will be a certain amount of time you have to readjust, but things will be better in the long run. It is not going to be smooth and easy for every single person, especially if you've been out there basing your business, basing your livelihood on breaking the law and hiring an illegal workforce. I think that gets missed a lot also.
You seem to understand that this may be difficult in the short term. This is difficult
right
now
for
some people. Yeah.
I do, and I've always said that. I think what the unfortunate thing is that there were associations, groups, some members of the media who, since the end of May, 1st of June, when we passed our legislation, basically led business owners, farmers, et cetera, to believe that it would never stand up, it's never going to go into effect, and then they were caught off guard when it actually did go into effect over last weekend. We were telling them for weeks and weeks, no, we've done a good job, we've done our due diligence, and we're going to play on the ball field that we're allowed to, and I think it is unfortunate that they did not do the things in a third of a year, 4 months, to change the way they were doing business so they can get over these last couple of weeks of harvest.
Do you believe that American citizens, people who live in Alabama legally, do you believe that they're going to go out to the fields and pick the crops?
there's always the argument that Americans or Alabamians will not do these jobs. And I don't believe that. Americans and Alabamians have done these jobs historically. I think they will do these jobs again. There may have to be some differences in pay scale, but I think those are things that people will see these opportunities. The pay may have to be different, but Alabamians and Americans will do those jobs.
That's Alabama State Senator Scott Beeson. He spoke with me from the Gardendale Civic Center. Senator Beeson, thank you so much.
Thanks, Robert. Y'all have a good day.
You'll notice that Senator Beeson mentioned wages. Here's the theory. Without all those undocumented immigrants, the supply of labor dries up. Businesses will have to pay more to attract new workers, legal workers. Tomatoes will end up costing more, but Alabama's 10% employment rate goes down. But theory isn't working so well on Chandler Mountain. Jamie Boatwright is seeing more legal workers looking for work.
Since this law has went in effect, I've had a total of 11 people that were Americans to come and ask for work. A total of one of those actually came back the next day. I told them, yeah, be here at 8 o'clock in the morning. That person picked 4 boxes of tomatoes, walked out of the field and said, I'm done.
Wow.
And so these Mexicans, migrating workers, it has nothing to do with race. It has more to do with work ethic and culture. They do this year-round. They are in shape to do it. They're accustomed to doing it. The majority of your Americans, you know, they may go pick something out of the garden for 15 or 30 minutes, and it takes them till the next day to get over it.
They're often referred to as unskilled labor, but this is a sort of skill.
Oh, it's a specialized skill. By the time I taught someone that didn't grow up in this field how to pack a box of tomatoes, the tomatoes would already be gone. You know, there's a lot of people saying, well, pay more. Well, when you go to the grocery store, the way it stands right now, if Alabama has this law and we don't have the migrant workers, and then you got all of our competing states that we are competing with on a daily basis that do have those workers, their tomatoes are going to say on average be 99 cents a pound. My tomatoes are going to be $2.99 or $5.99 or $10.99 a pound. And the people as a consumer, when they walk in and they say, all right, I got Tennessee tomatoes here for 99 cents a pound. Alabama tomatoes here for $7.99 a pound. They look identical. Which one are they going to pick up?
He's stuck. Boatwright can't use a machine to pick his tomatoes. He can't find workers for the usual wage. But if he raises his wages, his tomatoes will be too expensive. Jamie's wife, Lana, says she fears how this will end.
This problem's not going to go away for the state of Alabama. The farmers may go away from the state of Alabama. Some of the industry may go away from the state of Alabama. But there's not a Band-Aid you can put on this to fix it quickly if this law is fully implemented.
If it's any consolation, there is something that usually ends this problem, an economic recovery. UC San Diego Professor Gordon Hansen.
What we've seen after every U.S. recession in the past 30 years or so is once the demand for labor really starts to pick up, what happens is those same politicians who were preaching a tough line on immigration suddenly get softer.
Though Hansen says these new laws are so tough, it may be difficult to go back this time around if the law stays in effect. The U.S. Justice Department has asked a federal appeals court to look at the constitutionality of the Alabama law. The sports world lost one of its most controversial and compelling characters today. Al Davis, the owner of the Oakland Raiders, died at age 82. Davis was a rebel in the button-down world of pro football owners. He had slick-backed hair, black leather jacket. He brought a swagger to the game that came to define the entire team, the Oakland Raiders.
History will dictate what my legacy is, and Maverick is fine, because I am.
That's the late Al Davis in an ESPN documentary. Sports writer Peter Richmond is with me now. He's the author of the book, Badasses, The Legend of Snake, Foo, Dr. Death, and John Madden's Oakland Raiders. Peter, welcome. I love to read the name of that book.
It's kind of an awkward subhead, isn't it? Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
But what was the role of Al Davis in hiring, these are nicknames of players, Snake, Foo, Dr. Death?
Al found guys who played for coaches who treated them like players, and Al wanted to treat them like men. And so he had these goofballs. But they weren't all goofballs. A lot of them, there was a high goofball quotient. And they got to the Raiders, and Al said, I don't care what you do during the week. You're men. You're pros. I know that on Sunday you're just going to show up, and we're going to win games, and you're not going to make, you know, us look bad. You're not going to make yourself look bad. But you know what? You're men, so just live your lives the way you want to. So they didn't have curfews. And then on Sundays, they showed up and played their, you know, cliche-ish guts out for Davis because he treated them like men.
It wasn't just the players on the field that Al Davis took a chance on. I mean, he broke some barriers on the sideline and in the front office too, right?
He did. He hired the first African-American head coach. He hired the first Latino head coach. He was always proud of his ability to see beyond all racial stereotypes. The AFL, his first league, was more African-American percentage-wise than the NFL, but it was still pretty low. And Al made a point of making sure that African-American players and later coaches were not only welcome, they were going to be integral leaders early on, his captains and his team leaders, and then his coach, were emblematic of a certain enlightenment that unfortunately is going to get lost in the legacy of his overarching kind of maniacal ego.
You interviewed him, obviously, when you were writing this book. What was the first meeting like?
It was pretty bizarre. It was about 2 years ago. He was already pretty frail. His health was ailing. And I've never been more intimidated in 40 years of being a writer. I've never been in someone's presence in which I was just so awestruck. I think his frailty at that point made him even more dignified. It was kind of like meeting Caesar Augustus in the last few days. Just because he's no longer a great emperor doesn't mean he wasn't a great emperor. He did emanate this certain sort of, not only part of it was dignity, but part of it was power. I mean, it wasn't the illusion of power. It was power.
You talk about Al Davis's rebel image, but he also attracted a strange crew of fans. I mean, the Hell's Angels were fans. Hunter S. Thompson was sometimes on the sidelines. And, of course, there was a period there where gang members loved to wear the silver and black Raiders jackets. Why did Al Davis sort of really encourage this?
He was an outsider himself, and attracted outsiders and outlaws to celebrate the fringe, to celebrate, you know, if it were today, he'd be down with Occupy Wall Street.
That's sports writer Peter Richman. He was speaking to us about Al Davis, the owner of the Oakland Raiders, who died at age 82. Peter, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.